Okay. And this is just for your line.
Okay.
Okay, this is an interview I'm just going to introduce. So this is an interview with Dr. Monroe, an internist who is now retired. This is October 26, 1995. Okay.
So we're talking about my introduction to CME, and we're talking about being in the 11th Evacuation Hospital,
mm-hmm.
at first in Cheongju, Korea, and then Wonju, a little further north, and we became acquainted with a similar hospital down the road, a Korean Army Hospital. And so we would go back and forth. They would show us diseases that we knew about, but
mm-hmm.
had never seen. And forms of tuberculosis, for example, that we've never seen existed. And then they would come to our hospital, and we would teach them EKG and X-ray and present cases and so on. And
mm-hmm.
it was a very friendly relation. And I became very well acquainted with a Dr. Ki-Suk Wong. And when it was time for me to go home, I arranged for him to have an internship in New York City with Dr. Wasserman, the hematologist. And he spent 3 years there.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea would not let his wife go. They held her hostage because they knew he would never come back.
Wow,
if
she went with him.
So he went back and he became professor of hematology at Daegu University.
Wow.
So that was my first experience at CME. But in 1974, I had some surgery, and the doctor wouldn't let me go back to the office, so I'm sitting around, and I decided that this would be something I would enjoy, the CME at the hospital. Traditionally, it had been carried on by radiologists and pathologists.
And why was that?
They were the teachers, the professors.
Okay.
And, but it was sort of dilatory and sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody had an interesting case, well, I would love it, they would present it.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly it needed organization and something to make it interesting so that people would attend. So I did the job for about 17 years. And became involved with Dr. Mambrino at UMass, who put my feet on the right path. And taught me a lot, and then I became involved with the Massachusetts Medical Society on their accreditation review committee,
mm-hmm.
which members of which go to the various hospitals who apply for accreditation,
mm-hmm.
and then the members do surveys of the hospital to see that they're complying with the seven essentials of CME. And then we go back to our committee and report, and then the committee decides the length or kind of accreditation that we can grant to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in turn, are accredited by the ACCME, the Accreditation Council, which is a national organization.
Okay.
And I worked for them for a while, traveling around to accredit medical schools, specialty societies,
mm-hmm.
large hospitals which desire accreditation for their staff, large conferences which they have hold periodically.
Mm-hmm.
That was very interesting, but I'm a little bit older than I was, and I didn't enjoy traveling by air as much.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
So when did you stop doing...
Oh, right, this year.
Oh, that was really recently.
Yeah,
that
this year. I flew to Baltimore, and we had a terrible thunderstorm. Awful. And the plane shook like a leaf and bounced up and down. And I thought, well, why push my luck? I had been in an air crash in Korea.
Oh my gosh.
And we were supposed to fly home from Korea to Japan, and then from Japan to the United States, and I refused to fly. The Army didn't like it much.
So how did you get where you were going?
Well, I took a Korean cargo ship to Sasebo, Japan, and then I waited there about 10 days for a troop ship, which was going home to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing that I was there. There were two of us positions, because there were something like 16,000 troops aboard. There was one naval doctor, and the troops had been bottled up in Japan for several weeks, and so there was an epidemic on board ship of sexually transmitted diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So this other doctor and I worked 8 or 10 hours a day.
Was it the two of you?
Three.
Oh, three all together?
To try to handle all of this.
Yeah. To get it under control?
Yeah, we had to get some more. We didn't have a lot of penicillin.
When was that again? What year was that again?
Well, this was 1952, we were kind of. But we saw a lot of chancroid.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to incise the buboes, drain them surgically. I mean, it was good treatment to drain them.
Yep.
And then we put them on sulfonamide.
Uh-huh.
And we had penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
And the first broad-spectrum antibiotic had arrived, acromycin.
That was the first broad-spectrum?
Yep. And so we had that, and we ran out of penicillin, but we put in Hawaii, we got some more.
Sounds like you needed it.
Yeah. So anyway, that was, I wasn't enthusiastic about flying. I've been flying since, but I...
It's not your favorite thing?
Well, most of the time it's okay.
Backing up a little bit, you mentioned the seven essentials of CME.
Yes.
What are those seven essentials?
Well, about the time that this legislation was created to require physicians to have CME, there were about 7 or 8 different organizations providing continuing education for physicians. The American Hospital Association, the Association of Medical Colleges, all the medical schools, and the AMA, and they all were very territorial,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted it done their way. So finally, they got together and formed the Accreditation Council.
That's the big national organization.
Yeah. And they agreed that it would be organized under the seven essentials. The first is the mission statement. Yeah, I won't belabor these. The second is needs assessment.
Okay.
Third is objectives.
Okay.
Fourth is evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And the fifth and sixth are a little cloudy in my mind, but what they are is administrative support,
mm-hmm.
Budget, and library. And these things have changed, so we don't have any changes rapidly. So, and the last essential is joint sponsorship. Because for a long time, some outfit which might not be entirely ethical could be approached by the American Society of Holistic Medicine and say, we would like you to give credit to our doctors for attending a 4-day seminar we're putting on. And we said, this happened to me, and I said, what are the titles of your topics? And it was things like the value of magnesium salts and infectious disease and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I said no, but a lot of people didn't because they would pay the money to get, so that the parent organization would give them credit.
Uh-huh.
And so that joint sponsorship essential was designed to circumvent that. In order to jointly sponsor an effort, the parent organization had to be involved with it from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and see that all seven essentials, all six essentials were satisfied.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was really a large step forward because it unified CME throughout the country for the most part. Now, all states don't require their physicians to have
them. Oh, really?
No.
Oh,
about half do. And all state societies don't have much to do. In fact, some state societies don't do much. I went to visit State Society in Seattle, just because I was there, and I wanted to find out what they were doing while I was there to see if I could learn anything. They were amazed at what goes on in Massachusetts.
Wow, because living here and going to school here, I take it for granted that this is what everyone does. This is what you do as a physician. It's part of ongoing training.
You're living in a nice place.
Oh,
in spite of what's
here.
In spite of Senator Kennedy. Wherever we travel, you know, it's so fun. We have campfires when we go camping.
Mm-hmm.
And people stroll about campgrounds, and they like to stop by and visit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on our last little trip up to Raymond, New Hampshire, to be at the Deerfield Fair, beautiful big country fair, we met people from Minnesota, a beet farmer, beet sugar farmer. He is, I think he's in the
farming beets?
Yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, what are you farming? Talk about 200 square miles.
Uh-huh.
You know, a beet.
Uh-huh.
And then you trade futures in the market and all this. And, you know, I'm sure he's a good man. He had a camper the size of a Greyhound bus with a push-out living room.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, he said to me, "You're from Massachusetts. No, do you mind if I ask you a personal question? How can you people elect Senator Kennedy time after time?" I said, "We don't." "What do you mean?" "Is it Boston elects?"
Uh-huh.
"The rest of the state doesn't." "Oh, okay." So then we met some people from Texas. Same question.
Really?
Yeah.
So how do you think his policies have affected medicine in Massachusetts, or in the country even?
Well, I don't know, because
yeah,
much of what happens behind the scenes.
Yeah.
You don't see it in the media, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that he hung a little item. You know, they're very fond of hanging things on bills, like Christmas ornaments on a Christmas tree.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if they're passing a bill which says, "Congress strongly supports motherhood and apple pie," that's going to go through.
Mm-hmm.
So they hang little things on it, all of them do, as it goes by. And he hung on one bill something which renewed the patent on about 14 different medicines which were due to go generic this year. One of them ran into him. So Zantac, which is expensive,
uh-huh,
should have dropped down in price,
yeah,
but didn't. Now why would he do that?
Someone supporting his campaign?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Let's not get into
that. Okay, we won't get into that part of the...
Sure. Now, where were we? CME.
We were talking about CME.
So, I got on the Presentation Review Committee, and then the last couple of years I've been on the Committee of the Whole, Committee on Continuing Medical Education, and then just recently was appointed to a special task force to look at CME for the future, or more properly, to look at the place of the medical society in CME of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And a similar resolution was passed in the 1970s, which took the New England Journal out of a little bit of a backwater, very excellent publication, but made it a world leader.
And that was just back in the 70s?
Yeah. And we would like to do a similar thing for CME in Massachusetts.
How are you thinking about going about that?
Well, we're just beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We have three main objectives at the moment, which I won't go into. We had a meeting today in Los Angeles. We are going to invite 10 people who are preeminent in CME throughout the country, and in fact, one from Hamilton, from McMaster University, Dr. Dave Davis, also in Canada, to come.
Mm-hmm.
And to sit around the table from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon and brainstorm it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're not inviting anybody, the public, or doctors in general. We're just inviting the committee, the task force,
uh-huh,
the officers of the society, and certain members of other committees of the society to sit in the periphery,
mm-hmm,
and shut up and listen. And then every once in a while, there'll be a 10 or 15 minute period for question,
mm-hmm,
directed at the panel, and we're going to tape it, not for publication, but for our own use, so that we can sit down, use the information that we've gleaned, try and think about what we need to do about our objectives,
mm-hmm,
to the future. Are you, you're computer oriented?
More or less.
Yeah. Well, graduating students, by and large, are computer oriented.
Mm-hmm.
They will be increasingly so.
Oh, definitely.
As time goes by.
Definitely.
I am not.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a joke today at the meeting and said that I thought it was a good joke, but everybody was polite and they said the whole thing. I said, "I heard a new bluegrass song that goes, I'm only a node on your network, but I really want to be your modem. But I really don't know much about it. But students, in the future, it'll be part of life, like living, like breathing. And we can't afford to have people come, travel distances, to talk to small audiences, go from Boston to Athol for an audience of 35. You just won't be able to do it. So I think, we think, there'll be increasing dependence on individual, interactive, computer-directed education.
Wow.
Of course, then you've got to figure out a way to develop needs. What are the needs? What are the topics?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to produce it?
Right.
You know, you want to depend on commercial sources, you want to depend on society. I lean toward society because I have gone to accreditation surveys of certain accreditation companies that want accreditation. So that the people who buy their products can get credit. And I think they're very shabby. Videotape. Sure, you take a little quiz afterwards. You watch a videotape, take a quiz, and get credit. But I watched a few in dermatology, pediatric surgery, and they were stuff that you had in your second and third year of school. They weren't good stuff. Well, anyway, that's all going on.
That's very interesting. It's kind of the way a lot of things are moving towards using computers and interactive teaching methods. So it fits, I guess, that medical education would go that way, too.
But this ignores something that's important to me, you see, and that's collegiality. If I go to a conference, I'd love to have a bite to eat with my friends, even my enemies. I don't have to meet. If you're a practicing physician and you see the gastroenterologist you sent somebody to with GI bleeding last night, it's your opportunity to say, Sam, what's going on? You know, it's great. And you don't find that in individual, interactive computer education.
No, not at all.
But it will be a significant part of CME. But there are many, many aspects of CME that we hope to look at and move along. I think we're going to invite Dennis Wentz from AMA. And some people from ACME, which is the Alliance for Continuing Medical Education. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's a national, it's an international organization which meets in January, usually in some nice warm place. And about 700 or 800 people come. They're all, these are not doctors, all of them. They are CME coordinators. They're nursing educators. They're all sorts of interesting people. So there's that. And I think going to be fascinating. We're going to try and hold it in February. So, I resigned as DME at our hospital, about four years ago.
And had you been doing that full-time since?
Well, it wasn't a full-time job. I did it while I was practicing.
Okay.
But I did spend a lot of time there.
I'll bet.
Because it was very interesting. I tried to choose topics which would cut across disciplines so that you could attract the intern and all the primary care doctors. But you could also get the surgeon, the ophthalmologist, the orthopedist.
That's quite a trick to do that.
Well, if you pick something where once a month you will have a lecture in one area in an ongoing way, so I would do something like neurology. Now, everybody has people with neurological disorders. You can't get away from them.
Yep.
Or infectious disease.
Yep.
Now, things of this sort. Try to make it a broad... That wouldn't be the whole program. That would just be one part of the program to get people in. But it was fun. And I resigned because I had a lot of other things to do.
It sounds like you've gotten a lot of very active and... the Worcester District and the Mass Medical Society.
Yes.
Have you been doing that all along, too, or is that...
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. And at one time, well, I got very politically involved in Worcester District, but I realized that I didn't have the kind of personality which could allow me to practice medicine and be an officer in the medical community.
How so?
Well, because I tend to try to do something all the way.
Yeah.
So I almost ran as state representative.
Really?
Yeah, my wife said, well, two, whom would you have for a wife?
So that was that.
Well, she was that. But at any rate, let me start by saying that I began practice in New York State. I finished my residency in Boston in 54, interrupted by 2 years of the Korean War.
Which hospital were you at in Boston?
Boston VA.
Oh.
At that time it was run by the three medical schools.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what goes on now.
I couldn't tell you either.
Yeah.
No.
So Arnold Wellman, who was editor of the New England Journal, was one of my visits to the gastroenterologist.
Yeah.
Maury Strauss was the chief of the service,
mm-hmm.
one of the medical service. He's a famous renal physiologist. And Tom Wharton, the son of the man who described Wharton's death, was my chief of service at one time there, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they had so much teaching, we had a hell of a time working up our patients.
I'll bet.
But it was a good residency, and I felt somewhat insecure at that time. We didn't have a lot of money. And we had two children. We were the world's original plant parenthood. So there was an opportunity to join a group practice in New York State. And it was an HMO, decades ahead of its time. It was called the Rip Van Winkle Clinic. And it was in Columbia County, New York, which is a semi-rural community.
Mm-hmm.
And it was set up to provide specialty care to a whole county. And it succeeded. It had a lot of Rockefeller money.
Mm-hmm.
It was run by a very, he was a patron. Do you know what a patron is? It's a Dutch word, and it was in use in the Hudson River Valley. It's a feudal lord.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a professional, a semi-professional team in Albany called the patron.
There you go.
That's how I know it.
Yeah, a team of what?
I can't remember. I think it's a basketball team. I think it was a CBA basketball
there
team.
There you go. He was a feudal lord, and
uh-huh.
he although we had an executive group composed of physicians, his was the final word. And we had a main office in Hudson, New York, and we had five branch offices in small towns, and I was in the branch office.
Mm-hmm.
Each branch had two internists, a pediatrician, and a dentist.
Okay.
In residence. And the other specialties would visit. Would
mm-hmm.
rotate through the offices regularly or on an emergent basis, and taught me a great deal in a short time because I was it. Because there was supposed to be two of us, but as soon as I got there, the other one left.
That was just you, the pediatrician, and the dentist?
Yes, and I was responsible for 100 square miles.
Was that in miles, not in population?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Hospital was 12 miles away, and I made hospital rounds about 7:30 in the morning, came back to town,
mm-hmm.
and made house calls till lunchtime. Usually went back to the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and then had office hours from about 1:30 or 2 until 6:30. Had supper and went back to the office until 10 or 11.
That was the usual day?
Yeah.
Goodness.
Had no coverage.
So you were on call basically every single day.
And the pharmacy closed at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did you have your own pharmacy that you had access to?
We had a pharmacy in the clinic building.
Mm-hmm.
But I carried a bag that weighed about 50 pounds. I had it in the car. And I had an EKG that was about this big. And I carried around.
Uh-huh.
And so you had to have your medications and basic emergency equipment with you.
Always, yeah.
So you learned a great deal. And I didn't get to see much of my family, though.
No.
And I didn't make much money. My salary, I think, after about 6 years there was $17,000 a year. Now, at that time, $17,000 was probably equivalent to about $50,000 today. But still wasn't a lot of money.
Not for those hours.
And so I did get another partner eventually. And we became fast friends
We supported each other, and finally he left. His wife didn't like the fact that she couldn't have a good Catholic education for their children. So they moved to Southbridge. So he encouraged me to move here, and I did. I hated to because I had a faith practice, and I felt kind of chintzy about deserting them.
Yeah.
But we did, and my wife was delighted.
Is she originally from Massachusetts?
No, she grew up in upstate New York.
Oh.
Yeah. Incidentally, she was head nurse in obstetrics at our Harrington Hospital for quite a long time.
Also a great nursing job. Obstetrics and dialysis, that we talked about before. My two favorite.
Right.
If I were to be a nurse, that's what I would want to do.
Yep, they're happier.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved here, and we were received with open arms because the town had lost a couple of doctors. What we used to call general practitioners, what we now call family practitioners. Because a general practitioner could have a one-year internship and immediately go to work.
Really?
That was it. But not so with family practitioners.
Family practitioners?
Much better.
3 years of training still back then?
No.
No?
Didn't have family practitioners, just general practitioners.
Oh, just general practitioners.
Yeah,
okay.
Specialists. That was the only division.
Ah.
So. And I walked into a situation where there were a lot of animosities between doctors. Well, it was nothing new to me because the Rip Van Winkle Clinic had imposed all of these specialists on a network of general practitioners already in place. And so there were two general practitioners in my town, and I managed to establish friendly relations with them, but that didn't happen everywhere. You know, who are these guys coming in here, you know?
Were you considered more of a specialist then, having
Absolutely.
Done internal medicine, which is
sure.
which is now considered a generalist more or less. Okay.
At least I'd had, you know, 4 years of postgraduate training,
mm-hmm.
which is a bit more.
A bit more than one.
Yeah. So at any rate, I was accustomed to that. Your doctors would cross the street to avoid.
Really? It was that much animosity.
But they died gradually. But another nice thing that I learned, and it was customary, was when a new physician came to town, he would make an appointment to visit all of the physicians in town separately,
mm-hmm.
and go in and introduce himself, describe his training and general situation, and kind of get acquainted.
Mm-hmm.
Tell him not to worry, he wasn't out to conquer the world, so on. But for the most part, that worked.
Mm-hmm.
It's unheard of today.
I've never heard such a thing, to tell you the truth.
No. So anyway.
So did you have a private practice with your partner?
Here. We actually were not partners. We went to a lawyer and made an agreement, forged an agreement not to be considered partners for malpractice reasons.
Huh.
As it turned out, it was a good thing.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we were able to do several things for the hospital. We had progressive hospital administrators. After the first one, the one that was here when we first came left, we had better administrators after that. And so we decided in the early 1960s to establish a coronary care unit. We discovered that it was not really considered proper for a small hospital to have a coronary care unit. That's for the tertiary hospital.
Wow.
So we got acquainted with the man who invented the first cardioverter in Boston, and we went up to Harvard, and we would go up a day or two at a time,
mm-hmm.
and the chief resident took us under his wing and educated us about what was known
mm-hmm.
at that time about cardiac intensive care. So we came back, and we established a coronary care unit. That was very exciting.
Yeah, that is.
Yep.
My
very first patient was a gambler who never could see the doctor because he was too busy answering the telephone and taking bets. And he came in with ventricular tachycardia and he was in shock. And we had this elaborate ritual established, you know, where you're supposed to give him some pentothal, IV, do this, do that.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was dying. So I didn't do anything. He was unconscious. I put the paddles on. Shocked him. And
about 3 minutes, he sat up and he said, "Doc, can I have some supper?"
I thought that was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But we had a good time with that, and the coronary care unit was moved after the, it was a unisex unit. We had two female beds and two male beds, but all in the same room.
Uh-huh.
And we had wanted to make a bigger unit after a couple of years. But the Board of Trustees didn't think it was necessary until the president of the Board of Trustees came in one night with a suspected MI. And the guy in the next bed to him developed an arrhythmia, reared up in his bed, and fell over onto the bed of the president of the Board of Trustees, which he didn't admire too much. So he came to us and he said, "I think maybe you've got a good idea." So they put in a much larger CCU, which is the one we have now. Still with some modifications. Then we wanted to put in a doctor's office building because we were trying to attract a full spectrum of specialties to the area. We didn't have that. And people had to go to Worcester or here and there for, we thought that was unnecessary. So we pleaded and begged, but it turned out that the Board of Trustees was adamant because many of the members owned property downtown where doctors had their offices. They didn't want to give it up.
Mm-hmm.
So Van, that was his name, Bob Van Boren, and I heard they needed a couple interns in Falmouth where they were building a new doctor's office building. So Van and I both liked to sail. So good, we said, we'd move once, we'll move again, we'll go to Falmouth. So we came back and we quietly announced to the hospital administration that we would be leaving. So the Board of Trustees said, "Why are you leaving?" "Well, we said, we don't think we live in a progressive community. We'd like to live in one that has a doctor." So they decided to build a doctor's office.
Oh, so you stayed.
Yeah, and they built four units, which they had full before they finished it, so they added another four.
Mm-hmm.
I think presently they have 46 units there. And every specialty is represented except neurosurgery, and we don't need neurosurgery. So it's things like that that kept life interesting.
That's impressive growth.
Yeah. Well, Van Boren was big, tall, friendly, Flemish man. His family was Flemish.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to insult him by calling him a Wallon. You know, the Wallons and the Flems are in Belgium.
Okay.
And they are at each other's throats.
Uh-huh.
But his patients loved it. And he died a couple of years ago.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, that's sorry. Sounds like he was a really good friend.
Yeah, brain tumor.
Wow.
At exactly the same age that his mother did.
Really?
And it was not a type that's supposed to be
hereditary.
But they were operating, here's what it was like, they were operating on him at Brigham. And of course he was conscious. And partway through the operation he said, "Fellas, leave me my high school diploma, will you?"
So he even had a sense of humor on the table.
Yes, he did.
Wow.
But we did, and we finally got a third partner, who was black. Thought we would try and introduce a black doctor into the community. Didn't work.
Really?
He was a little strange.
Yeah.
Or as some people say, he had a geranium in his cranium. So he left us voluntarily after a year. And then we got Paul Steen, who later became president of the Worcester District Society, and then retired from the practice of medicine because basically he is a computer engineer. So you get into quality assurance, and he travels nationally,
mm-hmm.
Assisting various medical groups with their quality assurance problem. So then we got a very nice Italian gentleman in who had his residencies in Boston,
and is a dynamic, handsome man. All the ladies all loved him, but a good intern. And then finally, we took on a Polish gentleman whose education was in Switzerland, England, and this country. And so the four of us would cover one weekend in tour.
Which is a lot nicer than being on call every single night, like you were back in New York.
Yeah. Well, that didn't happen until the 80s.
That was almost 20 years later that you finally...
But we would take off Saturday noontime after we finished office hours and rounds and everything was quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an agreement that if some emergency came up, we would take care of it before we left, if possible. And then we would have morning rounds together at 7 o'clock Monday morning. And the poor guy who covered would tell us everything that had happened to our various patients in the periphery and in the hospital and so forth. It was a very nice system.
Yeah.
So, and I just love to make house calls.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about. What is it like making a house call? I have never made a house call. I don't know if I ever will make a house call. How is it different from an office?
Well, let's say you have a man in the office who has a lot of psychosomatic problems.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's my age or a little younger. And you really don't... You worked him up successfully, and you recognize this. And you maybe convince him by convincing him that psychosomatic symptoms are just as real as any other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really know why. So someday, for some reason, you make a house call. And you find out he's got a termagant of a wife. Okay? She's an anal retentive. Her fur is so clean you could eat off it.
Uh-huh.
And if he does anything, she yells at him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't do this and he can't do that. Of course he's stressed. It takes you about 30 seconds to discover that when you visit his home. But he's too loyal to tell you that, because he is a French Catholic loyal husband.
Uh-huh.
So, little things like that.
You get a little more information.
And the other thing is, I would go to their homes and they'd have all these wonderful smells, and I'd go out in the kitchen, and Mamie would be making her special relish. And she'd give me the recipe, and I still make her relish to this day.
Really?
Yeah, because I like to cook. I think house calls are wonderful.
Well, why do you think that they don't really happen anymore?
Lots of reasons. First of all, if you graduate from medical school with an average debt of $100,000 to $110,000, you've got to see a lot of patients.
True.
So how much time can you spend on a house call? How long does a house call take? Well, at least 15 minutes. Then you've got travel time on both sides to another house call.
Mm-hmm.
More likely the house call will take about a half an hour, because you'll be actually, much of the time, be having a good time. House calls were $5 when I started, and office visits were $4. My office fee got up to $25 by the time I retired, and a house call was $35. Now, Medicare will pay a nurse $60 to make a house call, but it will pay the doctor $35. Does that tell you anything?
Hmm. That doesn't make very much sense.
Well, don't expect government to necessarily make sense from our point of view.
Uh-huh.
That's one reason. The other reason is the time element.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the major. You can see many more patients in the office, and if it really seems to be an emergency, well, then it's either a clinic or an emergency room, which is overburdened the emergency room. They're taking steps here, and have taken steps to try and correct it. Most places have, but that's why. It was much more humane and interesting to see the patient at home. Good.
It definitely seems like it would be.
Well, now look. Let's say you've got an elderly lady who can't walk.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to bundle her in a wheelchair. Maybe she can't go in a wheelchair. Maybe she has to have the ambulance. How much does the ambulance cost? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. I know it's a lot.
About $100.
Why they don't really happen anymore.
I think we've exhausted that pretty well.
Okay, I think we have. Some other things I wanted to ask you about is kind of how you see the role of the physician in the community having changed from the time when you first started practicing to the present.
Well, the physician was many things in the community. He was not only a healer, he was a friend. An advisor, often. And he was active in the community. Most physicians did things for the community, with the community. They were active in service clubs. We did quite a lot of having public teaching sessions in the hospital or in other places to try and educate people about prevention as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, as DME, I made a series of 24 tapes, two 12 tape series on popular topics, and topics which people were concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And things like coronary artery disease, stroke, lung cancer, prostate disease, things of this sort. And I would invite the appropriate specialist within the hospital to make the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And I would prepare a list of questions, and it would be done interview style.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would go to the audiology department and into the soundproof booth, which is the only place in the hospital that was quiet. Really? And he would get the questions ahead of time, or she, and if they were not happy with them, they'd change them.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to tell a little joke or two in there to keep people awake. And we made those tapes and gave them to the public libraries.
Ooh.
And so, in all of central Massachusetts. So we put out, I think, enough for 74 libraries. And they were very popular. They couldn't keep them on the shelves.
Really?
People took them home and listened to them. And so we tried to do things like that. And socially, we were never very active socially.
Mm-hmm.
We're just not party goers or heavy drinkers. You know.
Uh-huh.
But we had a lot of friends. And this is a friendly town. They took us in. We had sold a home in New York State at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And had very little money. And we built this house. Went to the bank, asked for a loan, granted immediately. Got us started. So physicians were respected.
Mm-hmm.
And they were known. And of course, it's different in a metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
That's not generally true. But in the smaller communities, it is. Let me kind of regroup here. What else did we do? Well, we had families. And families were very important to all of us. In fact, as a side issue here, I think this is why America is headed for disaster, is because 50% of our children are being born now without dual parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand why they grow up to be aggressive and hostile, angry. I think that's perfectly natural. It's sad.
Yeah,
but we did. We had families. We were part of the community, not just a person rendering a limited service in a limited environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Next question.
Yeah. I was wondering if patients to you seem to have changed over the years, mainly in their attitudes about health.
I think they're more willing to ask questions, which I think is good.
Yeah.
The average totally cowed patient who would come in and listen to what you had to say and go out, really not understanding it,
mm-hmm.
I think is not the rule today. I hope not. And there'll always be the difficulty.
in a variety of ways. And nobody can teach you how to handle a difficult patient. They will probably try. Have they tried to teach you how to handle a difficult patient?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it much easier.
But the rules don't always apply. But your own natural ingenuity kind of comes to the surface. And then there's the lady who comes in, you know, and her laundry list.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you've got one appointment for her, which is maybe 15 minutes. It no longer is. I think it's 5 minutes now.
5 to 15.
I think it's 5 around here for the most part.
Really?
Yeah, I hear this. So, you really would like to examine her, but she's going through her laundry list. And I made notes in the chart as the patient talked. I didn't try to write it all down.
Mm-hmm.
Some doctors would wind up with a pile of charts at the end of the day and try to remember it all, but I couldn't do that. So, and you think, she could see she's going down. When she gets to the bottom, you know what she does when she gets to the bottom, don't you? She turns it over. So, you've got to find ways. What I used to do was, I'd say, Nellie, let me see this list. And I'd go over it quickly and check things off, and I said, we can save these for a later visit, Nellie. This is the important stuff today.
Uh-huh.
But I found with it. My office assistant used to knock on my door, and she'd say, Doctor, you've been in there 30 minutes. She only had a 10-minute appointment. We're having a good time,
uh-huh.
You know. And it was very fun for the most part. Have patients change. It's hard for me to say because I've been out of the office now for 7 years. But I still see my patients all over town.
Mm-hmm.
And I get 4 or 5 phone calls a day.
Really?
Yeah, for my patients. I had a call from a patient down in Connecticut, former patient.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's nighttime. He said, Doc, what'll I do? I came home, I ate my supper, and I vomited blood. I said, go to the emergency room right now. He said, yeah, I did. What did they do? I said, they didn't do anything. They said I was all right and sent me home. I said, did they take any blood? No. Tell me, I said, did they take your blood pressure? Yeah, he said. Well, he said, I came home and I vomited blood again. What do I do? And I said, go to another emergency. He said, I can't. My insurance plan won't pay for it.
Oh, no.
So I said, mortgage your house if you have to. Go to another emergency room. So about, a week later he called me up. He said, Doc, I want to thank you. He said, they really took care of me in that other place. And I said, what was wrong? He said, I had a big ulcer in my stomach and it was bleeding. God knows what they thought at the first emergency room. I don't know. But I still, these people
still call you. So you've been retired 7 years, but you're not really retired.
And so I see people in the grocery store and all this, you know, it's very friendly. And they tell me what they think is wrong with their present doctor, and I try to tell them that things have changed since I was in practice,
mm-hmm.
that we don't have certain luxuries that we had in those days, and that they're probably getting good care. But it just doesn't come in a package with bows on it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a plain package.
Yeah.
And they say, you know.
They said with a bow.
That's probably what they said about me.
That's
in the beginning, you know? Now, next question.
Next question. Okay. I was also a little curious, being someone who only has lived in a third-party payer insurance system.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like before? How did patients pay if they couldn't afford it?
Interesting. I'll say this quickly. I ran into trouble with the welfare system because it had just gone from being a town welfare system, which was certainly much more efficient, to a state welfare system.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things they did was say that I had to send them 15% of all my hospital records of the patients who were on what was welfare then. It wasn't Medicaid yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I refused. I said, these are confidential records, and I will send them if you can tell me who's going to look at them. I want to know that the people who are looking at them are as well qualified as I am. Well, they said, we can't tell you that. Well, I said, then I can't send you the charts. Well, I said, then we won't pay you. Well, I said, that's okay. So pretty soon I got a letter that said, it's illegal for you to treat these people for free.
Says who?
Says the welfare department. So I thought about that for a while, and I went to a lawyer. I said, could you research this for me? He said, sure. And I frankly said, I think it's a pile of nonsense. So he called me back a couple days. Hey, if you want to treat them free, go ahead. He said, no reason, you can't. But they were trying to intimidate me.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't get along very well.
Yeah.
We treated the clergy of any faith, Brahmins, Buddhists, whatever. we treated professional people, people in the hospital, the nurses, other doctors, social workers, unless they had some coverage.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a lot of it there. Hospital coverage, yes, but not outpatient care. And we just didn't charge them. We charged increasing amounts, as I told you, as the years went by, but they paid cash for their office visits. And the people in Southridge were predominantly French for quite a long time. A lot of Italian people came in later. And both people were very proud and did not want any part of owing the bill. And they insist on paying you, even if you knew they were dirt poor, made a house call. They'd run around collecting coins and money from everybody until they met your bill, which was very nice, of course. You know. But we really weren't charging large. But I have to parenthetically say that I was foolish, because I'm not a good businessman, and I never got rich practicing medicine.
Mm-hmm.
We are we're not starving to death. And we're comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I don't have a lot of money. And I didn't put in a big lab to do the well lab tests, you know. I couldn't be bothered.
Mm-hmm.
And I was foolish. And my office assistant got religion, and she became a Stephen minister, so she was spending a lot of time on the phone helping people instead of helping me with my accounts. And I had an accountant who was not very good. And I finally decided I'd like to think about retiring. I fired him and gotten another one. And he said, boy, Doc, I'm in trouble. They, together, had failed to pay certain taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the new accountant discovered what was due. And I paid it immediately,
mm-hmm,
in cash. Well, it took the IRS about a year and a half to discover that I had been tired. But when I did, they put penalties on what I had paid, because I was tardy, so we paid the penalties. And so they thought about it some, and then they put some penalties on the penalties, which is illegal.
Sounds illegal.
It is. So I consulted my accountant. He said, they can't do it, Doc. Don't pay any attention to it. But they harassed me for 5 years. They put notes in my door when I wasn't home, telling me if I weren't in Springfield, terrible things would happen to me. So I developed a form letter. Every time they did that, I'd send them this letter. And I'd say, please use the enclosed stamped self-addressed envelope to reply to this letter and save the taxpayer's money. Please tell me why I have to be in your office and I will help you. But they never did. So they never will. So one day comes a notice that there is a lien on the house of Ralph C. Monroe. Tax lien, which means you can't sell it.
Right.
So, this is just part of harassment. And I incorporated. And so, this house was never part of my corporate assets, so they had no right to put a lien on it anyway. And besides, I didn't own anything. So,
uh-huh.
Finally, we got hold of this very pleasant tax lawyer in Boston who teaches at Suffolk University. And he said, you don't owe him anything. That tax lien is illegal. I'll take care of it for you. So
6 weeks later, I got a letter from the IRS. The tax lien on the house of Ralph Siementhal failed to attach.
But what a number of years of harassment and...
Right. Some people commit suicide.
Gosh.
But anyway, I was not a good businessman.
Bet you were a good doctor, though.
But I was having good...
and enjoying what you were doing, it sounds like.
And we had enough to live on, and I was paying office expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one chief assistant, one nurse, and one sort of file clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many thousands of patients we had. We just never really counted them.
Mm-hmm.
We both had big practices. And I had a little semi-computerized thing where we would feed information over the telephone, and the computer, central computer, would send the information to the designated insurance company or government agency so that we didn't have to.
That's one person managing all that.
Yeah. So it got to the point where I decided to retire because my practice was still increasing in numbers of people, but my daily cash flow was diminishing. It would take Medicare 6 months or longer to pay bills. Medicaid had a cute little trick they'd do every now and again. We would send in a month's list of charges,
mm-hmm.
and it would come back. It would say, denied, wrong middle initial. Denied, wrong age. Denied, no such person. Denied, person not eligible. And so, my poor assistant would sit down, resubmit them all over again, and it would come back denied, beyond the billing period.
Talk about frustration.
Yes, financial frustration.
Yeah.
And so, I began to appreciate the fact that that my life was really not my own. I was like the retired admiral. You know the retired admiral syndrome?
No, what's the
physicians have this, you know, when they retire. Well, when an admiral is an admiral, he says, do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done.
Mm-hmm.
No questions. When he retires, he says, do it. And he gets one of three answers. Why, maybe, or no. Which makes him very upset.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I could foresee in so many different directions. I tangled with Central Mass Healthcare. One of their officious people called on one of my patients in the hospital one afternoon and said, you have to go home today. And the patient called me from her room in the hospital in tears.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I can't go home. There's nobody home. I'm all alone. So I said, don't worry, Ellie, you're not going home. So I wrote, I called, and I wrote Central Mass. I said, if you approach one of my patients in this fashion again without my knowledge, I will sue you for a minimum of $5 million, and I think I can win. So, they tried to get me later on. I don't want to seem paranoid. But I had a patient with diabetes who was not the best of patients. He was an alcoholic. I'm surprised he lived to the age of 58. But he was in our emergency room quite frequently, either with ketosis or hypoglycemia. And, or other problems.
Mm-hmm.
And one night I was in the unit and I had two critically ill patients there I was covering. And I could not leave the unit.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into the emergency room. And they called me and said, we want you to come down and see him right now. I said, I can't. I mean, yeah, I've got to see him. So I finished in the unit and I walked to the floor. And as I walked to the floor, here's my patient coming up on a stretcher. So, I don't know why I did this, but I jumped on the stretcher and I pounded on his chest and I reached in his mouth and I pulled out a big chunk of inspissated mucus. Seeing that the emergency room doctor had not actually seen him, he just sort of sat around there until things got very bad. He said, admit him, which is not very good. So anyway, we got him back in shape again. He was discharged in time. And sometime later, they did a quality check
mm-hmm.
on patients, their patients in the hospital. and they cited me for not having cared for that patient population. And I wrote them a letter, which was very clear and to the point.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I saved his life. If you want to point fingers at the emergency rooms, but not me. And so they wrote a letter to the quality assurance chairman of the hospital about me. They said, Doctors, Monroe's attitude toward managed care, anti-managed care plans is well known. But it, you know, things like that are not easy to tolerate. But more and more of them happened as the plans grew.
Mm-hmm.
And so, combined with the lack of cash flow, lack of autonomy, I decided to retire. Mm-hmm. And I've never regretted.
Sounds like you've been doing quite a bit in your retirement.
Oh, he does. He's kept, had to keep busy.
Yeah.
It was, you know, when he started, before he ever quit, he had three jobs. So he probably told you.
I didn't mention that.
American Optical as their plant physician.
No, I didn't.
That continued on for a couple of years after he retired, as well as Worcester District. In
Mass Medical. Well, American Optical has gone down the tubes gradually over the years, and I became their plant physician sort of part-time. I would be there two or three mornings a week, do complete physicals on the executives at a time when complete physicals were still allowable.
Uh-huh.
And then they had two very capable nurses there.
The nurses really ran the department.
Yeah, and it was a nice department, comfortable. Three examining rooms and a comfortable little waiting room. And patients would come in and they'd say, I don't feel too good. And the nurse would say, well, come on in. And they'd stretch out, you know, put a cold cloth on the head, take the pulse and the temperature and the blood pressure and say, what's the matter? And together the nurse and the patient would conclude that maybe the patient had some sort of a viral disease, no fever. And the nurse would say, well, it's 1 o'clock. Why don't you stick it out until 3:30, and that way you'll get a full day's pay. Okay. And the patient would. So that their absentee rate was fairly steady.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we had the usual preventive programs. We had a big flu clinic, flu vaccine clinic, and so forth, things of that sort. And we were there for emergencies, of course, which happened all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the nurses would watch each comp case with an eagle eye because the insurance companies would just as soon have them stay out. This may be hard to believe because then they can charge higher premiums next year to the company.
So backwards.
But the nurse would say, listen, Sam, we saw you with that wheelbarrow full of bricks yesterday. Now you get yourself back to work.
Uh-huh.
And they'd come back to work. So they're comp.
Well, that works.
They're comp. Thing wasn't too bad.
Uh-huh.
And so when they decided to close the medical department, Cabot Corporation came in. This is part of a multi-billion-dollar corporation. This is their safety division here in Southridge.
Uh-huh.
They're an oil exploration company, basically, and gas.
Mm-hmm.
They established this as sort of a tax loss thing here. But they were trying to make a go of it, so they decided to close the medical department and have the hospital take care of the whole thing.
Are you getting any information that you need?
Yeah, I got a lot of very good information.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to tell you something.
What?
That was your son.
Oh, good.
He got 7.5 hours sleep last night.
Oh, think of that.
They just adopted him.
They went down to Florida. The birth mother gave birth on Sunday.
Yeah.
And they went down to Florida to pick up the baby.
So they have to stay down there.
They have to stay there.
Oh, okay.
The mother has, what, 10 days, 2 weeks?
Well,
legally.
They're also the business of bringing the baby across state lines.
Yes.
But,
so they may have to stay there for a while.
So they'll be home the 4th.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. 7 the 4th sleep and he gets it home.
How old is the infant born?
Brand new.
Brand new.
Wow. That's really exciting.
Yeah.
Quite old.
Girl. Little girl. Yeah, they're just.
Yeah.
Is this your first grandchild?
No.
Okay.
We have three others. This is our fourth, but this is the most exciting so far.
Well, going through the adoption has been a stress on all of us.
Yeah, legally, the expense. The two social service departments, one down there, one up here. Oh,
had to deal with both of them?
Mm-hmm. And they weren't always on the same plane.
Not once, but either two or three times.
They had to write autobiographies, and the social service people came and grilled them.
Wow. I understand it's really rigorous and really expensive.
It is.
But anyway, then besides that, she's having fairly frequent stools. So I said I thought it was just probably transitional.
Yeah.
But besides that, she's taking 2.5-3 ounces at a time.
That's quite a lot.
That's too much.
Sure.
So I suggested maybe for the next couple of meetings they could hold her down to 2.5. Oh, they're older. Anne's 41 and our David is 36, something like that.
Anne is a choir director, organist, music teacher.
There's
45 students.
Wonderful person.
And David is a teacher in high school in Belchertown.
Science teacher.
Really?
Science teacher, yeah. Kid couldn't have better parents.
But I was tickled here.
Oh, that's great, honey. I was hoping that was him.
But I also have to tell you one other little joke, and then I'll leave you alone.
What?
Four started out from here. But he says, it won't surprise him if only three arrived in Florida.
Why?
Because they'll throw me laying out the window. Anne has
several sisters.
And she has a wonderful sister-in-law and a super brother-in-law. And one of her sisters and brother-in-law are going down, plus the other sister and the sister-in-law. But the second sister is a P-I-A-G race. Oh, but that was what David said tonight. He wouldn't be surprised if only three of them arrived. But they're going down there. They're having something that we had never heard of with an adoption, a rite of passage. And it's a religious thing. Even though we're Protestants, and Anne and David and the baby will be raised as Protestant, it's going to take place in a Catholic church, not in the big church itself, but in a little chapel. And it's sort of an official giving the baby completely over to Anne and David. And so that's why the other kids are going down. Sisters. So it's going to be there, but I never heard of it.
I've never heard of that either.
Well, thank you for that bit of up-to-date news.
Well, I couldn't hold it in.
No.
They're so funny.
They left in a whirlwind of...
Oh, boy.
Flurry.
But see, they couldn't even book passage or book airline tickets, until I knew the baby was born.
Which is hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and expensive. But anyway, they're there, everything's fine. That's great. Yeah. They're funny. Imagine getting that much sleep with a newborn.
Imagine 3.5 to 4 ounces.
No. 2.5 to 3.
Oh, God. I thought you said 2.5 to 4.
No.
So what's frequent on stools?
Oh, it sounds just like a transitional.
Oh, okay.
Nothing, no problem.
Good.
She's not gassy. She's not crampy. She's just fine.
Good. She's still swimming.
Oh, like crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. But you figure Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, she's just about 4 days old.
They took her out for a walk in her little snugger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She liked that. Fell asleep.
David got up with her this morning because he said he'd already had 7 hours sleep. But Dr. Mill's place is decorated in black and white and red.
Yeah.
And Heather thinks those bright colors are wonderful. So he says, we stop and look at a bright red picture for 5 minutes and then we go on.
They're going to be, David was headed for veterinary. This has nothing to do with anything else. Veterinary school. And he had his master's in animal science from Colorado, graduate of UMass.
Mm-hmm.
He taught in Ohio State, part of their agricultural program. He taught horse. And then he went to Colorado.
After he got his master's in Colorado,
he came to Ohio. Then he went down to Virginia.
He became breeding manager.
Big Arabian farm.
One of those things that you see in the movies with the white fences and all the horses off the fields.
Tons of horses, you know, beautiful horses.
He
could handle horses, animals of any kind.
Oh, yeah.
If they were being fractious, he would walk up to them and talk to them right in the ear. And you would see them, gentle.
Your kids have done some incredibly interesting things.
Yeah. He met his knee.
Oh, don't know.
A dying foal fell against it and gave him a real football-type injury, and he couldn't handle the stallions anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So he came up and went back to UMass and
got
his teacher's
credits there.
Credits.
Mm-hmm.
And he applied to Grafton. And the first year it opened, he was first alternate.
But that's when he didn't wait. That's when he went on out to Colorado.
And then he didn't wait. He went to Colorado. And then he applied the second year,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't even give him an interview.
Really?
So he kind of bulled his way in to talk to the admissions people.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to this guy who got up and closed the door, and he said, "Look, kid, you've got two big problems. You're not black, and you're not Filipino."
So it's gotten that bad in veterinary school?
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful.
You see, vet schools are not like medical schools. States buy seats.
Really?
In veterinary school. And Massachusetts does not own all those seats. In fact,
no, they only have about four or five.
They only have four or five
seats.
The whole state.
Out of 50. The rest of them are sold to other states.
Is that because there are so few schools?
Well,
I'm sure that has something to do with it.
Yeah.
But Massachusetts used to have them at Cornell in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Penn State.
See, we used to have seats there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we lost
them.
And
then we got our own
medical
school. We lost our seats in those other two states. So that really there's only about four or five seats for Massachusetts kids here.
Isn't
that crazy?
Incredibly competitive, that is crazy.
It
yeah.
is, and there are very few large animal vets left. They're mostly pets.
Mostly pet vets.
Dogs and cats,
mm-hmm.
whatnot.
Birds.
Birds, important things like that. So David was quite disappointed, but he had a good teacher.
He found his bag.
Yeah.
I have lost my book.
Oh, I put it over on my desk, honey.
Oh, that's why I couldn't find it.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
So anyway, Cabot and A.O. had the hospital to take care of, and I said, I want to come back in 6 months, and I want to ask you a couple of questions. I said, we're glad to see you anytime.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back, and I said, what's happened to your absentee rate? They shuffled papers around, and they looked a little embarrassed. They said, well, it's gone. Oh, okay. And, what's happened to your average stay out of work with cop cases? He said, this is their personnel director. Well, a good friend of his.
Mm-hmm.
He had leukemia, and he has survived it. He's had a bone marrow transplant and survived it. Very well. Very courageous man. So we're close, and he felt he could tell me these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, do you personally, just between you and me, feel you saved any money? Did the company save any money by doing this? He said,
mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, let's try to save money.
Yeah.
What else? Do you have another question to ask?
I think I've asked the ones that I've outlined. Do you have anything else that you wanted to ask?
I could probably talk to you until dawn, but I won't.
Okay.
I actually would like to write a story about my time in Korea. I really love it.
I think that there would be an audience very interested in
yeah.
me that. And I've read an article you wrote in the Worcester District Bicentennial magazine.
Yes.
It was about the history of Southbridge.
Oh, yes.
And it was wonderful to read. So I think that your writing style is
I
great.
I write stories about cats.
About cats?
Yes.
Really?
We had cats for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And cats are self-contained. You know, you can't go away and leave a dog, but you could leave a cat.
Yeah, that's why I like them.
Yeah, what time do you have to be there, Sarah?
I have to be at work for 8:30.
Okay, well, we better.
Not a big deal.
I wrote a story called Igor the Horseradish Cat about what happened when our long-haired cat developed a liking for horseradish, what happened to his personality. And then there's Max the paper-eating cat,
uh-huh.
who liked to eat the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get terribly sick when we read the headlines about the train crashes in Bangladesh, the fire in the Swiss school that killed 37, and
mm-hmm.
even that, he'd get awfully sick. So the vet put him on a diet of paper towels moistened with milk for a week. And then finally we just had to edit what he could eat. He loved the funny, so he agreed.
That sounds like a great story.
But one night, we heard him crying. Illegal part of our Internal Revenue Service form.
Did you really write this down, or are you just telling
me
a joke?
No, it's true. It's all there.
Oh, that's clever.
I like to write things like that. And I gave the annual oration last February for the Worcester District Society and had the opportunity to go through the library at UMass. We have a room there. The District Society has a room there.
So the room, as you go in on the left and the back?
Yeah, in the back. Yeah. It's just for meetings. In fact, you have to fight your way in there to use our books.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got all of the annual meetings of the Society going back to 1880. And each one was held an annual oration. So I went back and read the annual orations to compare the problems that doctors perceived with the practice of medicine then that they have now, as doctors perceive now. And what it really turned into was an examination of the ethics of using medical care to make money at the end. So that's coming out of the next issue of Worcester.
The next issue of this magazine? I'll look forward to reading that.
Okay. Now, we have a bathroom over here, if you'd like to use it.
I think I'm all set.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, though.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Really? Oh, our scene. The interaction between nurses and physicians changed dramatically.
Oh, how so? That's very interesting.
Because when I started practice, the nurse was a handmaiden.
No more.
Well, she was a good handmaiden and much respected.
Uh-huh.
But when the doctor came on the ward, she was expected to stand and say, "Good morning, Doctor so-and-so," or
really?
"Sir."
You never called them by their first names, that's for sure.
No.
Wow.
And the doctors made all the decisions.
Uh-huh.
Right or wrong. And woe betide the nurse who tried to interject, you know, that maybe this was not just the right thing for this patient for this reason.
Well, I'll tell you something. The nurses didn't have the good training.
No, they didn't have the education.
It was more bedside nursing care. But as the years went on, they were constantly learning.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that they sometimes felt quite qualified to challenge a physician.
That's right. And then we started having conferences, clinical conferences, where the social worker, anybody in the ancillary services who was concerned, be it the audiologist, the physical therapist, the nurses, and the doctor, would sit down and make turnarounds, maybe once a week, maybe twice a week. So that was a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And then we hired a nurse to manage our coronary care unit, and she and I just like that. Needed each other.
Oh, that was not the first one.
No, not the first one. Well,
that
first one, she did the last one, but when Peggy came.
Yeah.
But she'd had more training. And so now we're the best of friends.
She's a lot.
She is now the vice president of nursing at the Harrington
Hospital. Oh, wow.
But she knew.
She knew as much about reading EKGs and interpreting them as the physicians did.
But physicians
and probably
can.
More than some of, like, physician practitioners.
Physicians couldn't have
family doctors.
See, it's a bruise to their ego.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, she told me recently that I used to watch her masseter muscles, she said. And when they would tighten up, she said, we would all head for the hills. All by your little self. But anyway, finally, we have become members of a team.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened long before I left, actually.
That's good.
It did.
Yes, I
didn't
agree
have any
with
problem
that.
With it, but a lot of
as
doctors
a nurse.
Couldn't tolerate it. The older doctors.
There are still a few that resent it.
Yeah. But